You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, 6 months ago, Representative Mike Johnson was probably not known by most Americans. Bit of a backbencher. Not a lot front and center. And then, of course, everything changed, as is often the case in critical moments of politics and policy. And now, of course, he's been in the middle of some of the crucial conversations around national policy, international policy as well. And we want to go beyond the headlines of what we think we know about Speaker Mike Johnson. And whether you like his politics or dislike his politics, there's something interesting and some important lessons beyond the headlines. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, last week, of course, we saw the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, go forward very boldly, saying, I will do what I think is right, and even if it costs me my job, so be it. The job of the Speaker is to bring it to the floor and let the will of the Congress move things along. And so as we look at the Speaker of the House, again, not widely known to most Americans until recently, and someone who's done that deep dive that gives us a different perspective, not just the headline stuff and not just what you're going to read on social media. It is a brilliant deep dive piece, one of the best pieces I've seen in The Atlantic in a very long time. Elena Plot Calabro, staff writer there at The Atlantic, on The Accidental Speaker. It's a great read. You need to check it out at Atlantic.com. And Elena, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So let's dig into this. You got the deepest of deep dives on the Speaker of the House. Let's just start with some of the things. What surprised you the most going into this and coming out of it in terms of what you learned about Mike Johnson?
That's such a great question. In some ways, you know, I think everything surprised me. What intrigued me about him, I mean, exactly as you were saying in your intro, was that, you know, even as somebody who covers Congress, I didn't know much about this man at all. He was in a role called vice chair of the conference, which is ostensibly a leadership position, but it doesn't really matter much. It's a messaging position. I always say he was virtually a backbencher to kind of get around that technicality.
Yes.
But I think what I quickly found to be quite interesting and in some ways surprising, though not really that surprising when you sit down and think about it, when you consider his colleagues like Steve Scalise or Tom Emmer, these were other people who ran to succeed Kevin McCarthy. Both of them have been in House leadership for quite some time. So in some ways they had an infrastructure in place should they become speaker just to hit the ground running. Mike Johnson had none of that. He only had what's called a personal office. So the staffers that, you know, if you're a constituent of his, you're dealing with day to day, if you have, you know, issues at home. So when he became speaker, I mean, it's really tough to overstate the 180 his life took. So the kinds of adjustments that he was making that maybe his more seasoned colleagues wouldn't have to deal with were really hugely monumental for him. So suddenly he has Capitol Police outside of his house at all times, you know, joining him anywhere he has to go. He's surprised to get calls from international reporters wanting to know about his family. I mean, I think it's important to emphasize how for him, this wasn't just a personal or professional transition, excuse me, but just a hugely, personal undertaking as well, and something that his family has had to deal with, too.
Yeah, I thought the way you covered just that, basically having 15 minutes to put together a major staff, most people don't recognize how small the staffs are on the House side of the building over there. The Senate staffers are a little more in numbers, but those House staffs are so small and they are so personal. It is dealing with that constituent issues for the most part. And so I do think that was an amazing pivot for him to be able to do that and put together a team and move it forward. Give us a little sense. You dug into his background as well and some of the things that have shaped and influenced the way he's addressed the job and even some of the tough decisions he's made, even in the face of opposition within his own party over the last week.
I think one of the most important things to understand about Mike Johnson is that he is a child of the 80s. He's someone who grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana. So for your listeners, that's Northwest Louisiana. This is not kind of what you think of when you think of Bourbon Street, New Orleans. This is closer to Texas culturally, East Texas. And for him, Ronald Reagan really was an idol. And he really admired from a young age how Ronald Reagan and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill seemed to have, you know, a great deal of respect for each other. They disagreed on policy and politics, but at the end of the day, kind of worked with each other with an implicit trust in the other's good faith, if that makes sense. And he found that hugely formative in terms of forming his own political identity. So civility, I think, you know, rather early in his political career became a bedrock of his own brand. And for him to transition to the speakership in a moment when civility, to put it lightly, is rather detached from the heart of the Republican Party and politics more broadly right now, I think this adjustment we've been talking about, because it's so ingrained in him and makes so much sense to him, what I noticed through my reporting is that, you know, there was a lot of naivete, I think, that was motivating how his approach to the job early on. I think, again, when something is so logical to you, you just sort of think, well, if I just sit down with people and explain that, you know, working with each other with a baseline of respect is a good thing, then surely they will understand. But what he discovered very quickly is that the people that he was trying to work with a trust in their good faith were not doing the same with him. So I had one member of Congress tell me that that was probably the biggest wake up call for him, that, you know, it's not just for a lot of these members. It's, you know, a very selfish enterprise about their political brand, their social media brand, not necessarily working every day with the good of the country in mind. So really adjusting to that dynamic in that sense, I think, was kind of a shell shock for him.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that led him back. Obviously, he and his wife have a partnership that's very extraordinary in terms of the way they approach things, what they're willing to sacrifice individually and together in order to take on this role and take on this particular moment. What did you learn about that? And what does that tell you in terms of what we might expect moving forward from Speaker Johnson?
Well, I would say in terms of his partnership with his wife, you know, they've been married for over two decades now. They met shortly after they, or right when he was on the cusp of graduating from law school at LSU. She was an elementary school teacher. And kind of in a continuation of what I was saying earlier, you come into a job like the speakership and you sort of realize how few people around you can actually trust to give advice with your best interests in mind. Everybody has an angle, obviously. And I think from my conversations with him, as well as his wife, she sat in on one of our interviews. What he was explaining to me is that it's so helpful to have someone with you at all times who you can go to for guidance, who you know only has your interests in mind. People, it's rare to have people like that around you in Washington. And so I think he really has leaned on her to an extraordinary degree, in a way that I certainly haven't encountered in the, you know, political spouses that I've covered in my career.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And give us a sense in terms of how he is approaching some of these issues. Obviously, the way he navigated the aid packages, dividing those up into three, much smaller, much more focused, kind of giving everyone the chance to vote for the ones they wanted, not for, you know, the ones they didn't like, as opposed to a fake fight and a false choice of just either or, all or nothing kind of things. What is it that that you sense from him in terms of kind of the guiding principles of the job itself, as he's come to understand it and actually live it now for about 6 months?
That's a great question. I would say for his first 5.5 months as speaker, like I said, I think he was really trying to achieve a consensus that just didn't exist on a lot of these issues, and try to get people to yes who never wanted to get to yes to begin with, right? So people like the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the conference. And, you know, sort of encountering those growing pains that these people don't want to be part of the solution necessarily from the outset. But also, I think for him, it was, when we think about the Ukraine aid packages that passed this past weekend, I think for him, it was really important to get to a place where he wasn't just trying to protect his job security anymore. And, you know, once that, my understanding from his team is that once that consideration, he was able to put that to rest, he felt a lot freer just to do what he thought was right. Mm-hmm. And I should say, you know, it did take him quite a few months to get to that position. You know, that it was back in February that the Senate passed their own foreign aid package with aid for Ukraine, the Indo-Pacific, and Israel, and he just wouldn't bring it to the floor. That would have been an opportunity for Democrats to step in and give him the votes he needed, just as they did this past weekend. But he was unwilling to do that, like I said, because he was still sort of bent on achieving this consensus that finally he realized just didn't exist.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting thing. And I think he went in with this idea of building the relationships and getting to that consensus. And I think particularly with the former president weighing in on so many different things and it being not about relationships, but about transactions. I think that was a bit jarring for him from my observations. We had him on the show a few weeks ago with Congresswoman Malloy. And to me, it was he's figuring out those that you can have relationships with and those members on both sides of the aisle and in the White House that you're just dealing with one transaction and the next transaction will probably be totally different. Was that part of the learning curve for him? How do you see that?
I think it was absolutely part of the learning curve. I think maybe even more crucially, and, you know, to expand a bit more on his origin story, there is, in terms of ideology, it doesn't get much more conservative than this man. I mean, there's a reason that when he became Speaker, Matt Gaetz immediately anointed him MAGA Mike. This is not somebody who, if you just look at his voting record, that any Freedom Caucus member could credibly call a squish or anything like that. He was never part of the Freedom Caucus, but Jim Jordan, one of the group's co-founders, was his mentor from day one when he got to the Hill. So philosophically, he's very aligned with that far right of the conference. And I think part of the adjustment for him was sort of realizing that that didn't help him at all. I think he sort of thought that, well, these people that are upset with the decisions I'm making, people like Chip Roy or Marjorie Taylor Greene, if I can just remind them that we're on the same team, we have the same policy goals, then perhaps they'll extend me some more grace. Mm. That didn't happen. And so I think part of it is in some ways early on was a denial for him, you know, of all the people who could have been most vocally opposed to his speakership. I don't think he ever envisioned it being, you know, people like Chip Roy, who was his own mentee in Congress, right, and now is, you know, the first to the microphone on the House floor to lambast whatever it is he's just done.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. This is a fantastic piece at The Atlantic. Elena Plot-Calibro, staff writer at The Atlantic. Brilliant work, fantastic writing, and great insight into the Speaker of the House. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Again, great perspective there. And again, whether you love his politics or dislike his politics, there are so many lessons in there. It's worth just sitting down and doing the deep dive read because it's way beyond the headlines. And I promise you, you'll think again about what you think you know about the Speaker of the House. You'll learn something and maybe even a principle or two that you might be able to apply in your own world as well. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
It's finally time to say goodbye to the snow and hello to spring, and right now is the best time to spring into adventure in an RV from a Motorsportsland RV Center. Through this week, come check out Motorsportsland's season kickoff event and find the RV you've been dreaming of. Save thousands and even tens of thousands off MSRP and find your next adventure at a Motorsportsland RV Center today.
Let Motorsportsland help you get away.
Motorsportsland.com.